Hello and welcome to episode 43 of Let Them Eat Cake. My name is Jack. My co-hosts are John and Ace. Today we will be continuing our discussion with Sino Talk from last episode. We dive into the South China Sea territory disputes and more this episode. But before that, just like always, let's get into some headlines. So my first story is going to be about the Islamic regime in Iran has carried out another four executions of Kurdish men. They've been accused of being involved in a terroristic plot with the Israeli intelligence agency Mossad, according to the regime's state media on the morning of January 29th. The accusation levied included an apparent plot to target a factory belonging to the regime's defense ministry. Mossad apparently trained these four men.
Mohammed Farah Marzi, Mohsen Mazloom, Vafa Azarbar, and Pijman Fatahi.
These four men were all Iranian Kurds, and the Islamic regime has a habit of killing Kurds and blaming Mossad. The accusations also include that they were trained in an African nation before returning to Iran itself. Now, this isn't out of the ordinary for the regime, as I mentioned before. They've also recently carried out the executions of three men and one woman last month for a similar, if not exactly the same charge, with a number executed this year alone apparently hitting 65, potentially more. The director of the Iranian NGO, Iran Human Rights, commented that confessions were acquired under duress and thus likely coerced false confessions. Also commenting that the global community should show a practical response to the relentless and daily executions by the Islamic Republic. This is unfortunately just more of the same for people under the Islamic regime, a regime that Amnesty International and other human rights groups claim execute more people than any other nation on earth besides China. There's no point really softening.
They're literally slightly more humane Daesh.
Yeah.
At least they're hanging them and not crucifying them.
True.
That's how you can end it. That interjection from me.
Okay, that'll be worth. So for the second story, I'm going to be covering the use of AI to harass women. The first one that I'm going to be covering briefly is the Taylor Swift controversy that went around where AI images were circulated that were made from a Microsoft program that is not meant to simulate nudity in its algorithm, yet they used certain key terms to simulate a sort of nudity and then spread it among Twitter, which is an important point because the next one is also being circulated on Twitter, but also that Twitter can choose to stop these things because they banned searching Taylor Swift, period. So this is just more evidence that Elon Musk is allowing neo-Nazis, anti-Semites, you know, just general pieces of shit, you know, people who apologize for the Assad regime, those sort of people just exist on Twitter, but you know, they can easily ban this in a couple of days. So the second part of this is the polar opposite. The second story is about a new account that popped up on Twitter called Dignify, spelled basically Dignify, but the last bit is AI because it's an AI being used to put clothes back on women, which is a funny idea, but then you have to realize that it's still taking the likeness and the image of these women who have chosen to put it up on the internet like this and then taking their agency from them and projecting your perversions, fetishes, whims, whatever you want to do, whatever, however you want to phrase it, projecting them upon these women. And this is as much of an issue as the AI taking clothes off women. So the account was originally shared by a notorious fascist and one of the primary voices in the anti-trans movement, Jack Posobiec. Basically unleashing this algorithm onto his 2.4 million followers. So even if you say, oh, it's not harassment, he gave it to 2.4 million people that follow him. So you can imagine what these kind of people are going to do with it.
And nobody's going to do anything because they don't care about sex workers to begin with.
Well, yeah, exactly.
You can harass them all you want, and people think it's justified always.
Exactly, exactly. And it's like the main thing that I want to get across here is that this remains a violation of privacy, even if the argument is, oh, but we're putting clothes back on them. It doesn't matter. It literally does not matter. They have not given you permission to modify their images. Them posting them, it's still their image. This is, I don't know how this is so hard for people to understand. So it takes the agency away from these women, and it also and it inserts yet another power dynamic into this equation where people are just trying to get away from those things. So ultimately, the story is about protecting the autonomy and agency of women. If you care about that, then share the story. Yeah, nobody's picked it up yet because it's literally brand new. There's one article on it. So, yeah, this needs to be spoken about.
And the U.S. just passed a bill called the Defiance Act that's protecting specifically against AI sexually explicit images. It's tacked onto an existing revenge porn law.
Mm-hmm.
So there's not to insert this into the revenge porn law. But I think if you just change the wording on that law, using like images of somebody's likeness to harass them.
Yeah. And that would even classify like people who screenshot your pictures and like use them as like insults is still using your likeness.
How do you feel about the guy who goes, this is what you would look like as Black and Asian? It's like a meme page that always responds.
I won't even lie, it's kind of funny.
I agree it's funny, but to be consistent would also be impacted. Just for consistency's sake. Right?
He's funny, it's but still, he should be clamped down on too.
Yeah. Like if he's gonna do it, message the person. Ask him. Most people would probably also be like, go for it.
He's using AI, you know? Like
no.
So it's like, is it just AI that we're talking about here? Or like people actually going through the work of like using Photoshop to do stuff? Maybe he is using AI. Who cares? Either way. There needs to be restrictions in place for AI in general. Now, normally we do underreported stories. This is obviously not underreported. So as everyone has heard by now, the very well-televised American strikes on Iranian proxy targets inside the territories in Iraq and Syria are being conducted. They're ongoing. This is a response to an Iranian proxy group that killed 3 American soldiers and injured about 30 just a few days ago, five days ago in late January. The attacks occurred in an area I've coined the Golden Zone, and it's basically this area between the Iraq and Syrian border where strikes happen constantly. I always talk about, people are like, what about bombing Iran? And I'm like, we bomb Iran like once a week. And it's in this Golden Zone. You never hear about it because nobody cares. Iran doesn't care. The US doesn't care. Nobody reports on it. But recently, they thought it was originally connected to Kataib Hezbollah. Not to be confused with Hezbollah in Lebanon. This is originally a Saddam resistance group. They've gained increasingly unpopular. I believe they're the group that you see in the Mosul Netflix movie when they say, we don't like those guys over there. I think that's supposed to be them. But anyway, this is a different group that uses the name Hezbollah who conducted the strikes. They're also called the 12th Brigade, to simplify it. And the U.S. code is HHN. So that's believed to be the group who conducted the strikes. We don't know for sure, but they came out of Syria and they hit American targets in Jordan. If you actually like look at a map, we don't normally screen share, but let me pull up a map because it's relevant to where the base was hit. See, this is the Tower 22 right here. It's right on the border. This region right here is what we call the Golden Zone. Literally right here, this road that connects in from Iraq and Syria, that's where all the strikes always happen. So that said, there's no evidence that the group actually knew it was inside Jordan making these attacks. The base is close enough to the border. And that's an interesting part of it as well, which I'll get into a little bit more. But it's a relative free-for-all zone. And basically all parties are aware of this agreement. America really only will respond if soldiers get killed. The only reason that this drone strike was successful on this American base is that an American drone was conducting an operation and returning. So they thought the drone that was incoming, that was on the attack, was that drone returning. So they didn't use their phalanx countermeasure on it, which is a big machine gun that you'll see. It shoots a bunch of bullets in the air. You see them on ships a lot. There's a famous video where it targets like a civilian airliner and they're going, no, no. And it's like letting the intrusive thoughts in. And the rounds explode in the air so that way they don't fall down and injure people. It's a very interesting defensive weapon. They use them on embassies and stuff. So there have been about 160 strikes in 4 months. And only about 10% of those have caused retaliation from Americans. So it's unclear whether the proxies that did this are directly controlled by Iran. You'll see this all the time where people say, oh, they said Iran did it. They said Iran did it. With Hamas, they do it with October 7th. There was, you know, neocons saying we have to go to war with Iran because they're behind October 7th. There's no evidence that Iran was like, hey, bomb this base in Jordan. If anything, Iran would have told them no. This also might have been a retaliation for a strike inside the Golden Zone that killed a Iraqi Hezbollah, Kataib Hezbollah leader. We're not sure, though, because these strikes just happen all the time.
Can I just interject here for a second?
Yeah, go ahead.
On a couple things. So the first thing you mentioned that a lot of people like to directly blame Iran for these things. A thing that's important to note, a lot of the groups we're talking about in these situations have existed before they kind of came under Iranian control, and there's still a level of autonomy in their actions. So a lot
to
of
interrupt, this one that supposedly did the strikes started with the Syrian civil war, but that's not really exactly relevant to what Ace is saying at all.
Yeah. And so it's kind of, that's one thing. A lot of these groups retain their relative autonomy to kind of do what they want. Things aren't as always connected as people think. You know, a lot of these proxies, I mean, like, just think about how hard it would be to if they had to coordinate, like, you know, we're talking, they've done over maybe like 300 strikes on American targets at that point. Imagine if they needed to ask Iran every time they did a strike. That doesn't make sense. Like if you're at work, do you ask your boss every time before you do something? No, you just got to do it sometimes. And then the other thing I wanted to bring up is this happening in Jordan. You are you getting to that, or do you want?
Yeah. Okay. But if you want to add stuff, I'll add on to what you have to say.
Yeah, basically, I mean, a lot of people are shocked because Jordan did participate in the retaliation strikes against these groups.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people found that to be odd. In reality, it is not that odd. They've been doing it for years, but within the last maybe 2 months alone, Jordan has carried out maybe two or three strikes against drug smuggling groups within Syria. And they carried out these strikes. Granted, they were meant to target drug smuggling groups in Syria, but in reality, they ended up targeting civilians, as happens quite often. But yeah, so this isn't something that's not very shocking for Jordan to be involved in something like that, given they're already doing it. The second aspect of this is a lot of people are worried. Every time something comes up with Iran, people are worried about it possibly escalating. I think people need to realize, and we've talked about this in our stream about the Houthis, is that when it comes down to the U.S. and Iran's proxies, it's really just a tit for tat. Nothing ever seems to escalate beyond a certain point. It's like, you know, you hit me, I hit you. You hit me, I hit you. And that's all that ever really comes out of it. It's never more than that.
Yeah, and that's basically what I was going to get into next, is that the underreported and odd part of the story is that Jordan participated in the strikes, only the strikes inside Syria, though, not Iraq. And initially, Jordan even denied that the strikes happened inside their borders because they're reporting to their own people, right? They told their own people, we weren't attacked, because they don't want to seem weak to their own people. So they can also lie to them saying, nah, we didn't bomb them. They might tell them the truth. They might not. But yeah, like Ace said, this whole warmongering that we need to bomb Iran, we need to strike inside Iran. I'm a firm believer that the U.S. does bomb Iran. It's just when they do, it's very covert. Iran doesn't report on it because they don't want to look weak, and the U.S. doesn't report on it because they don't want the fallout from it. But there's reason to believe, not in this series of strikes because there's going to be too many eyes on it, there's reason to believe that a lot of people were criticizing how telegraphed these strikes were, right? Like, why warn them 4 days in advance that we're about to bomb them? Well, maybe these groups are either going to stay in place, right? But another thing is that they're going to start moving around munitions from places we're aware about into more hidden places, you know, and it's like watching the mouse go back to the hole, right? If you just catch one mouse, you're not going to stop the mouse hole. You have to follow the mouse back to the hole. My second story, Ace especially has reported on this, but the coups in West Africa between Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger, simultaneously, all three televised that they were leaving ECOWAS. ECOWAS is the Economic Community of West African States. It was founded in the 70s to protect democracy and stuff. Lately, it's seen as just an extension of Nigeria's control over West Africa. These three nations, they recently formed like a military protection style, Article 5 style mutual defense pact, which everyone should know that Article 5 is the NATO thing where if somebody gets attacked, they all come to the defense. All of these states have been dealing with an insurgency by ISIS. And so there is reason for them to come together. We also, in a upcoming episode where we talk to private military contractor, we talk about this federation being formed in that episode that was filmed a little while back. So what's important here is the coups. They're even in the videos, you'll see them flaving all three of the country's flags and then a Russian flag. So they keep on linking this to be Russian backed, Russian this, Russian that. And again, just like Iran, it's, you need to calm down. Sure, it's Russian backed, but what they're also rebelling against is the Western flawed democracies that have been in place. Young people have been increasingly disaffected by these regimes. I think some of these juntas made great arguments saying like these countries are supposed to be democratic, you know, and they mentioned a certain country as a dictator for 40 years. It's not actually democratic. I think Mali was one of the more democratic ones. No, it was Niger was really democratic. It was considered one of the jewels of democracy in West Africa. So these young people who are going to be more radical and more eager for change. And as we've said multiple times, Africa is a huge young population. And it's something that needs to be paid attention to because it's going to change the dynamics of the continent. And that's what we're seeing here is the young people are in favor of these hardline populist strongmen military dictatorships. And this year, 2024, is going to be the year that democracy dies. There's more elections, more people voting than ever before. And we have only given way to authoritarian regime. And to tie into this, the EU just did a $54 billion aid package to Ukraine. Orban didn't want to do it, as we know. And then he was basically beaten into submission. There's a funny picture of him basically crying at the table when they finalized this. And I think this is important to point out because it's been half a year. Ukraine's running out of munitions. America was supposed to supply this a long time ago. Why aren't they? All because they want to make the Biden economy and all that shit look bad. Trump is straight out said he hopes the economy collapses to get himself elected. He stopped a border bill because he thinks it'll make himself get elected. This is not what America should be doing. Like, people need to wake the fuck up and realize that the EU is now showing to be more democratic and functioning better than the American Union. It's an embarrassment. Like, you should be ashamed as an American citizen at the state of your fucking democracy. It's outrageous. The fact that somebody, literally, if Donald Trump goes to prison, he's going to be like a mafia boss running the mafia. The fact that a criminal who is not in power, is not elected, has more influence over our Congress right now than the president of the United States. Like, QAnon is almost right that Donald Trump is still the real president. It's fucking ridiculous. Wake up, start getting involved, and like make a difference here, because it is the year where it matters more than anything else. You'll see it all the time, especially communists will say, they always want to say this is election is the most important election. First of all, that's never been a thing. They didn't say it about Gore. They didn't say it about Romney. It's never been a thing. It specifically happened when Donald Trump ran for president. Okay, so shut up. Now on to more democracy. El Salvador is having elections. I think this is very interesting because Bukele, the self-styled world's coolest dictator, is likely going to win. There is not like, as far as I've seen, there's not like super like repression on opposition parties and things like that. He's so popular as a dictator, a self-styled dictator, that he's actually going to be the first dictator to win by like 85%. You know, they always pretend to do that. And when you talk to people on the street, they're just talking about how they don't care about the democracy as much as they care for their own safety, because not necessarily the most democratic way or human rights way of cracking down, but he did mass incarcerations. It's not exactly ethical. So we don't know how many people in these incarcerations are innocent and now in with some of the, because El Salvador is notorious for how dangerous the criminals are there. So I guess you could say that's one place where democracy will function, even though it's to keep a dictator in. Also, just a side note, the Philippines, we might want to keep an eye on that, because Duterte's party and the Bongbong Juniors right there, they kind of like broke their alliance. I don't know over what, probably China or some shit. Argentina, everyone has been watching this saying that it's going to be a fascist takeover. There's been a lot of protest here and people are like, oh, it's protest against Milei. But I want to point out that the Amines bill that he's passing is still going to the lower house. The lower house did vote for this. It's not just him running the country. It's still, it would be like protesting against our omnibus bill that Biden passed, you know? So I think that people who are left-wing are just angry that he's elected, like how we would be with Donald Trump in the past. But I should be clear that it's not exactly like him being a dictator and forcing this bill in. Their democracy is still functioning as it should be. What's interesting is they asked him if there was a plan B if the bill doesn't pass, and he said there is no plan B. And to wrap up, I just wanted to highlight, it's a video by Sky News that they just put out. So if you go on YouTube, it's how Breonna Gay was lured to her death. This is the trans teen who was stabbed to death. So it's like a quick 3-minute story. It's very interesting because they basically use signal intelligence, open source intelligence, and all this stuff to piece together everything that led up to their death. So they show her on CCTV, they have the text messages, they show how everything went down. And it's really sad because she's like on the, because she's has anxiety and stuff. She's like on her bus going there to, you know, an hour from her death, texting her mom how she's on the bus alone and she's really nervous. And the mom was like, you're doing great. Like, good job. Like, you can do it. I believe in you, you know? And like, I just like imagine the mom like looking back at those messages, encouraging her daughter to like be brave and go out. And she ends up getting stabbed, I think, over 20 times with a large hunting knife. And so, I mean, the case is still ongoing, but it's pretty much, as far as evidence goes, they have everything to convict these two kids that killed her. So I think if you care about trans rights and what's going on in the world with trans representation, you should go to Sky News, check out how Breonna Gay was lured to her death. That's the name of the story. And with that, I'll pass it on to whatever Ace wants to talk about now.
Alrighty, on to the Congo. So where the March 23rd movement, or the M23 rebel group, has made significant gains in the area over the last 2 days. The group has seized the villages of Shasha. I'm going to butcher some of these names if I'm being honest. But Shasha, Bweremana, Katuva, and the hill areas of Murmur, and Nginwe, all of which are in the North Kivu province, which we have discussed before. This has caused a large-scale displacement of the population in these areas, and this has cut off the regional capital of Goma from the rest of the DRC. So since there are some other updates I want to get into. That's just what happened over the last 2 days. But since January 23rd, a lot of fighting has taken place between the Congolese military, the M23, and militias affiliated with the Congolese military in the town of Maweso in the North Kivu province. This has led to the killing of 20 civilians, including children, due to bombs and artillery fire. Both the Congolese army and the M23 accused the other of being responsible for the bombing. Again, we don't really know who did it, but they're going to trade accusations for the time being. Last night, a bomb landed just outside the regional capital of Goma, killing one person. This bomb, while not confirmed, was most likely launched by M23. And then the M23, this has been going on for a while. Obviously, the M23 conflict and the conflict in North Kivu is very old. But if we're talking recently,
The M23 have been making significant gains towards the provincial capital of Goma since October. And in the process, they've been basically cutting off Goma from the rest of the DRC. They've finally done it now with the taking of the three villages mentioned and the hill areas. So basically, this area is cut off. This is also coming amidst the UN mission in the DRC known as MONUSCO, planning to pull out of the country entirely by the end of 2024, and amidst a highly controversial, contested, shitty, whatever you want to call it, election in the country, which saw Felix Tshisekedi, the current president, retain his seat amidst a lot of protests and a lot of people saying he won it unfairly. And, you know, if you want to learn more about the March 23rd movement, M23, whatever you want to call them, you can go back to our episode with Antoine Brimbal of Modern Insurgent. But to basically give you a little summary, because I like doing this, is that basically it kind of formed in 2009 when former Tutsi rebel groups known as the National Congress for the Defense of the Peoples integrated the Congolese Armed Forces. And then it began sprouting up in 2012 when the M23 basically accused the government of the DRC of enabling deteriorating conditions and not upholding previously signed peace treaties, which led to the M23 rebellion, which lasted between 2012 and 2013. And that conflict killed about 7,000 people and left 140,000 displaced. To go back even further, a lot of Rwandan rebel groups, such as the Banyamulenge and the Rally for Congolese Democracy, these Rwandan-backed groups went into the Congo to hunt down perpetrators of the Rwandan genocide, such as the Interahamwe and the Hutu Power Movement. But in the process, of course, that's not really how it went down. They actually ended up just killing a lot of Hutu civilians. And the M23 themselves are primarily made up of ethnic Tutsi, who were the victims of the 1994 Rwandan genocide. And that is the ethnic group of the current Rwandan president, Paul Kagame. The M23, as far as we know, has been accused of being supported by the current Rwandan government. Rwanda viciously denies this, despite there being a boatload of evidence to suggest that they are, such as photographs, the import-export of cobalt that occurs in Rwanda. It's one of the world's largest suppliers of cobalt, and it does not have a single active cobalt mine. And yeah, that's kind of the little summary of it. If you want to know more, like I said earlier, we do have that episode with Modern Insurgent up where we go into it in more detail. But yeah, that's what's going on there. Do you have any questions, John?
Well, I also wanted to comment on quickly about Palestine and how a bunch of countries withdrew aids to the UN organization that was basically in charge of feeding people, because three people were linked to October 7th out of like 13,000 or something that work there. How do you feel about that?
I think it's a pretty stupid move.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So Netanyahu agrees, apparently. He asked people not to do it. He said that it's a bad idea. And I think a big part of this has to do with the ICJ ruling. They said that they need to, Israel needs to take charge of making sure aid gets to more people. So now Israel is going to have to pick up the slack of that group being defunded. And it's going to put more pressure and more resources that are going to be taken away from their military campaign and put into this. So, conspiracy theory, maybe some of these countries did it on purpose, because you can't go against Israel because there's a large percentage of the population that's pro-Israel, you know, like in America. It's just bad. You know, people give AOC shit, and she's like in New York, where there's a lot of people who support Israel. Like, you know, she has to preserve her own thing, and she's not going to straight out call it a genocide. But this might be kind of a subtle way of them to put pressure on Netanyahu to end it, because if they're pulling funding for this organization and he has to step up the funding, then he doesn't have to fund them if he stops bombing them, basically. That's all. Anything else we want to touch on?
I just wanted to say the UN has employed people who worked for the Assad government in Syria, and mm-hmm. I believe they've employed a lot of really fucked up rebel commanders in the DRC as well. So a lot of this grandstanding, I almost agree with your conspiracy in that sense, because it seems like too much moral grandstanding to even be true about three UN employees who, for all we could have known, have been janitors being involved in the October 7th attack. So that's all I wanted to add to that.
Mm-hmm. All right. So anyway, okay. here's yeah, our here's our episode with Sinotalk. And this was part one of two. You can go back and watch part one.
Two of two.
This is the first one that Jack finalized the master editing in. So if you have any issues, make sure to direct them at Jack and not me. I did most of the editing, but he finalized it.
Okay. It was two of two, but I said it, so you can just cut that and leave that in there. That'll be fine.
We have a weapon more powerful than the British Empire, and that weapon is our refusal to bow to any order but our own, any institution but our own.
Anyway, I wanted, since we're talking about the Uyghurs, and I figured if we wanted to talk about Falun Gong, we could connect that with the organ harvesting, because Falun Gong loves to exaggerate and report on the organ harvesting.
Before we go into that, I wanted to ask, even though it's like purely speculation and it's just a theory that I have, but how connected do you think the ramping up of the sort of tightening of the grip of the Uyghurs has to do with the Belt and Road Initiative?
I think it has to do with a lot of it. The Belt and Road Initiative is Xi Jinping's legacy in a weird way, because he's trying to use that as a, or for various means. One is to reestablish the Silk Road. I know a lot of people are like, oh, the Silk Road, you know, BRI is just another Silk Road 2021. Like, but no, it's like, that's what they're trying to do. And not only that, but, you know, expanding into the maritime domain as well. That's where the port in Balochistan actually comes into play. Not only that, but, you know, they're trying to regain and expand their historical influence from not just, you know, the Central Asia region, the Southeast Asia region, you know, and in Northeast Asia, but to expand it globally to where they can actually say to themselves that we're in our rightful place of the global order.
Mm-hmm.
But then with that, they know that any militancy that would take root in Xinjiang would go after those projects. Not only that, but you also have to take into account that a lot of China's nukes are located in Xinjiang.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
A lot of their strategic ICBM infrastructure is located right there.
Hmm. I did not know that. That is very new information. That's very interesting.
Yeah. A lot of people think that it's, you know, it's located, China actually has like all their ICBMs and on like televector launchers that are mobile. No, they, before that, they've copied the United States and the USSR and made a lot of silos in Xinjiang.
That's crazy. Mm-hmm. I had no idea. Very interesting. Okay, so now that that is being covered, we can go into organ harvesting. Is it real?
I mean, it is. There's been a lot of evidence. It's very well documented through, you know, the UN before they decided to lessen their degree of coverage on it because of China. Amnesty International does some stuff, but again, going back to Epoch News, you kind of see a bias towards their work. And then with Epoch News, as John pointed out, they kind of exaggerate. Well, not kind of, but they do exaggerate on certain topics. And again, I'd like to point out, that's not discounting the work that they do. It's just the fact that, you know, the CCP does a lot of stuff that doesn't need exaggeration. It just, whenever you do exaggerate it, the CCP uses that, and it became quite proficient at this, by the way, at using that to point and destroy our entity's credibility. Say, oh, well, we don't do this. We obtain 1 million Uyghurs and rape the women until they get pregnant, but we don't harvest all their organs, but we don't really do any harvest organ. We don't do as on the scale that the Epic Music does, says we do.
Yeah, it's easy to dispel something that's overinflated.
Exactly.
It's like, no, we don't do this.
And then Adrian Zenz comes along. We know about him.
Yeah, he does a lot of work in this, and he actually got a lot of flack from Heineken, because of one of the papers where he says that, or one of the articles he wrote that actually says, hey, Heineken, your Chinese a subsidiary forced the beer that it produces to literally be used to subjugate Uyghurs by making them drink it.
Yeah, there's like, you know, like the rumor of like the halal organs. And I always tell people, like, they make them eat pork. They couldn't have the halal organs. You can just sell halal organs. You can harvest them from whoever you want and just say, hey, it's halal. Pay a premium. You know?
Right.
Like,
right.
Who are we kidding with that? You know, like, they can get halal organs from whoever.
Yeah. It's one of those things in which the CCP knows how to play the card that they had, that they were dealt. Mm-hmm. Not only that, but, you know, to work with Adrian Zins. And the reason why I highlight that that specific piece is because Heineken actually came out and said, oh yeah, this, we examined this before, and you know, in some university think tank employee, you know, that's what they called him, Zins. Oh well, I mean, he's totally wrong. I mean, he doesn't know. You know, the statement was half disparaging and almost mocking his credibility. And it was just, I mean, like, you're a multinational company. I mean, you don't need to say some of the stuff like this or frame it as such. But then again, we know who wrote this article. Mm-hmm. Or then again, we know who forced you to write this statement.
I think we should just kind of touch up on kind of China's projects in Africa. I mean, they seem to be taking a pretty big risk there. Recently, I think Al-Shabaab attacked like a Chinese. Yeah, it was a Chinese funded project. No, it was not. Never mind. That was not a Chinese funded. It was a project, but it was not a Chinese funded project. But a bunch of Chinese miners in the Central African Republic, like a few months ago, got like kidnapped and then freed by Wagner. So there seems to be like a pretty significant risk to operating in China, and I'm sorry, for China operating in Africa. And so like, kind of what's the goal there? What's what are they trying to do? What's the outlook over there?
So I think with, and regarding the that one incident you talk about, there's a lot of rumors and speculation of who actually conducted the attack. Because
yeah, with that country, the Central African Republic, you can never really know. Or are you talking about the mining incident where the Chinese miners were killed? Because I'm talking about the one where they got kidnapped and they had to get rescued.
Both, actually.
Yeah.
If you're talking about
the attack on the mine, there's the Wagner and some back in like 2018. It was like, no, not 2018. It was like earlier this year, back in like March or something. There was like a lot of
article here says March 19th.
Yeah, there was a lot of back and forth between Wagner and a militia group called the Coalition of the Patriots for Change, basically accusing each other of killing the miners.
Yeah, so I mean, it's one of those things in which they both have their reasons to do it, in which so I don't know, like, that's the reason why I say, like, that's illustrates the risk that China faces with operating in areas such as the Central African Republic and Somalia and the DRC and in South Africa and Nigeria, is because these are places that are not the most stable politically and then also economically. Now, the reason why the Chinese may have felt safe enough to go in to mine in Central African Republic, it was because of Wagner providing security, but at the same time, Russia, or Wagner by extension, Russia may not have the best interests at heart, just because of the fact that while China and Russia are friends, they still see each other as historical enemies as well. But it illustrates just the sheer amount of risk for them to actually go in and try to develop a lot of these areas in Africa, because one, they really don't know who to trust. They don't really like to enter domestic politics of the countries that they're friends with or they try to interact with. They say it's an internal problem. We're just here to exploit the minerals. And exploit the population, but mainly the minerals. That's the thing with the BRI projects, is the fact that there's been a lot of documented evidence that the promises that the Chinese companies and the Chinese government made, saying that, oh, we're going to provide your workers with the skill sets so that one day you can build your own projects, so that you can be weaned off of Chinese or international assistance. That has not ever came to pay. Not one country can say that they benefited in that way under the BRI. Matter of fact, some countries can actually say that it was a negative. That a lot of the people... Go ahead.
With Ghana, for example, I know some stories. This is like very anecdotal, though, because there's all these people, they were like getting oil. They found oil in Ghana, right? So they gave the contract to a Chinese company, and the Chinese were supposed to build it, but it was supposed to employ people from Ghana, mm-hmm. but it didn't. It only employs like Chinese people, and it's actually is what helped contribute to Ghana's recent economic decline, mm-hmm. is these contracts.
Yeah, that sounds about right. That's another thing about the BRI is the fact that, you know, they're supposed to provide jobs, but they don't. Well, they're able to provide jobs to the Chinese companies and the Chinese people who want to come to Africa and build out to work there. Local population, oh well, you're not supposed to work here. Unless you're cleaning toilets or doing other menial work that the Chinese don't want to do. Those are your jobs. And that actually led to a lot of protests. No, I believe in Zambia, Botswana, and I want to say in the Republic of Congo, Brazzaville, I want to say there was some protests in that area as well. Go ahead.
Never mind. I thought you said the Democratic Republic of the Congo, but you were right. Brazzaville, like the Congo.
No, it's like I know how to when you dated someone from the Congo, from the ROC, they'll make you like write a report about it. It's very awesome. It's very awesome. It's like, no, we're our own state. We're our own state. I'm like, okay, I get that. I'm sorry. I apologize. Anyways, it's one of those things in which China wants to move into Africa because they can see this as a potential source of natural resources, but also to increase their diplomatic influence, whether it be benign or covert. And the reason why I say covert is because the African Union building that that China built for the organization, a lot of people say that it's just one big spy satellite or spy bug or spy device.
Okay, we're going to be shifting a bit here, but this is kind of what you write about a lot. And I feel like, you know, what sort of conversation about China isn't complete without this. What's the deal in the Indo-Pacific?
Speaking of that, Bhutan, I guess, just moved closer to China. So they got 1 point on their side now.
Well, I mean, with Bhutan, are you talking about they're finally delineating what China wants the border to be, or?
I don't know. I just saw a headline that they moved relations closer with China.
No. It may be because of that, because they've also been trying to push the Bhutan to establish diplomatic relations with them, which I don't know if they will, because in a sense, they're a Tibetan people. And so it's kind of weird that they're trying to establish relations with them when your kin is being, you know, genocided culturally.
That is very strange. It's very strange how countries act, though. Some things don't make sense.
In a weird way, Bhutan is trapped between two giants, India and China, in which I kind of want to know how India feels about this. Because Bhutan, you kind of seen them play India off of China to, you know, at least stay out of the conflict between them two powers. Mm. But then after the Gourds incident, I think it's referenced there. I think it should be referenced in that article, actually, the South China China Morning Post. But after that little dispute between India and China on Bhutan,
I'm not subscribed, so
yes, it's fine. But yeah, it's funny because after that incident that happened, you kind of see them being pushed into a corner to where they have to decide whether or not they want to be align more with the Chinese or align with India, in which I think this is their attempt to maybe see what the Chinese will give them, which is there going to be much. And then on the flip side, they may just go back to India and say, this is what the Chinese are going to give us. What's your take on this? And play them off each other.
It's going to be a very interesting few years, I think. Mm-hmm. Nobody who's come at who China's come at has really come out in a good place.
But the generally results more related to the South China Sea, though. So I wanted to just get there.
So, I mean, for the South China Sea has been heating up lately. The Philippines, especially with the Philippines and China. But the most notable incident, or the most significant one, was them hitting, was the ramming incident near Second Thomas Shoal, I believe 2 weeks ago, a week ago.
They rammed two ships, right?
Yeah, they rammed two ships each, rammed each other. You know, a lot of people were saying, well, this is going to escalate tension. And I was like, not really, guys. And the reason why
there does seem to be a lot of like just like random shit slinging that happens in the South China Sea and nothing happens. Like it's just people move on. Like I feel like I hear about an incident in the South China Sea every like 3 months.
Exactly. It's true because, you know, like this instance, like take for this the ramming incident. Like, a lot of people say, oh, we're gonna go to war, it's like remember the boat, like no we're not. The United States isn't gonna go to war with the Philippines over the maritime equivalent of a fender bender. I mean, like I know this sounds like disparaging or like, oh, you're siding with the Chinese. Like, no, you have to look at it from a non-biased perspective, showing what each country would gain from doing that. Nothing. No one will gain if we start just shooting people in the face over ramming. Now, that doesn't say that the Chinese, that this wasn't a deliberate act against the Chinese, against the Philippines by the Chinese to show Chinese displeasure against the Philippines sending construction supplies to the Second Thomas Shoal. This is what it was. It's that them saying, We told you multiple times not to send construction supplies to the Second Thomas Reef or Second Thomas Shoal. We don't really care if your Marines fall through the rusty hook of this World War II era LST. We do not care. Remove it, and then we'll take over the island. If you do not, we will detain the next step. This was never hinted at, but I'm pretty certain this is the next step, is that they're going to detain the crew. They won't fire warning shots at them, not yet at least, but I can guarantee you that within the next one or two incidents, a Philippine supply vessel, the captains, the crew of whatever Philippine vessel, supply vessel that they end up stopping will be detained and sent back to China. I guarantee you. And then that's whenever we can talk about escalating to a fighting war, to an actual shooting war. Because
keep going.
No, I was going to say, because after that, you're detaining naval or Coast Guard personnel of a sovereign country that is proven under international law that in their own territorial waters under international law, not China's BS little historical law that says, oh, we always been here since the Ming or Qing or whatever dynasty. No, the international community uses facts. Get with the program.
So what is like China's sort of gripe or strategy in the Indo-Pacific and the South China Sea? Like, well, what's the I guess end game for them here? What's the point? What are they trying to do?
Well, in the South China Sea, it's multi-pronged. One is so that it can get control of the entire South China Sea because of the potential for mineral deposits, natural resources, and whatever fish that still remains after the Chinese fished it out. But then not only that, but there have been talk that the Chinese Navy may be able to send their ballistic missile submarines down there as a sort of deterrent patrol to launch ballistic missiles against, you know, the United States, Russia, etc. And then also with that, just to be able to control the Straits of Malacca as well. Because if you control the South China Sea, you essentially control who enters and who exits the Straits mm-hmm. On the Pacific side. India, by default, controls who enters on the Indian side. So, but going more widely to the Indo-Pacific, I think their end game is to push the United States back out of the Pacific, but out of the Pacific and reestablish regional hegemony over the entire area. India could try to fight back, but the Chinese know that the Indians may not put up a fight as long as they're left to their own devices. So that's one of the reasons why some of the strategies they use against the Indian Ocean region differs significantly than the rest. But for them, it's to obtain hegemony over the entire area, with this emphasis of pushing the United States away from, you know, Japan, the Philippines, South Korea, Australia, just to push them away.
How far do you think they're willing to go to achieve that? Because that's a pretty lofty goal, if you ask me, but I don't really know much about the region.
I think they're willing to use every tool, so to speak, available to them, short of military options or military options. You see them using diplomacy, you see them doing economic and financial, some intelligence, but you don't really see them using the military perspective, at least kinetically. You do see them doing some exercises with various Indo-Pacific countries, the most notable being like Laos and Cambodia and Thailand and, to a lesser extent, Indonesia. But the first two, that's a given because they're closely aligned with China, Laos and Cambodia, and then Thailand. They're doing those exercises as a more balancing act between Thailand and United States. But with Indonesia, they're beginning to implement that strategy as well, so that they can hopefully balance between the two countries, but with a more emphasis of siding with the United States and reluctantly Australia.
So the first one is obviously something that's kind of been on the radar lately, but hasn't really been in the news. You know, shocker is a lot of rebel groups in Myanmar are making really big advances on the military junta there. And as far as we know, pretty much one of the only states that's given any sort of time or support to the military junta in Myanmar which appears to be like kind of decaying, is China. So what does China stand to gain from supporting junta in Myanmar that's been, I guess you could say, shown to be kind of weak as of late? And, you know, what's kind of the MO there? Is it just like an old alliance that's kind of still there, or what's the deal?
It's more of a, they'll be able to maintain their holdings, be able to maintain the pipeline they have there, and then also some of the economic initiatives that they have, like the seaport that they built in southern Myanmar. But for the Chinese, they also see Myanmar as a potential ally, even if the Myanmarese government doesn't see the way, or the junta don't see that, because the junta is very nationalistic. They don't really like receiving overt help, or like even having like state visits by China, by various troops. They don't like it, because their whole thing is that we're protecting Myanmar's sovereignty against foreign invaders, like the British. But for them, they really don't want to be seen as close with China, though. You kind of get that feeling. Because, one, they fought the Chinese before, the Republic of China. They fought them before. Now, in fact, one of the earliest insurgencies was a Chinese division, Republican division, that left China, that retreated out of China into Myanmar and fought the Burmese government to a standstill for how many years? Decades, actually, until they were withdrawn to Thailand.
And I guess the last question is, and this is, you know, the million-dollar question, so it might be a little bit silly, but, I mean, how likely is China to invade Taiwan within the next however many years? Is it a sure thing, or is it eh?
It's a I mean, I know that a lot of people, you'll probably receive a lot of criticism, you and I, this podcast and myself, because of what I say. They don't really have the capability to conduct a logistical operation, to conduct the operation logistically, but then also see to command and control aspect. See, right?
Just no, that's
from the record.
They can't. How much? And then plus with the United States deterrence that has already been in place, and like we were laughing just to wrap up here with the stuff going on in the Middle East right now. It's just like, you know, the like it's like maybe it was the meme with Walter White screaming in the back of the van, and it's like China hawks realizing CENTCOM is going to be the priority for the DOD for the rest of time.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things in which I don't really see the Chinese considering potential for CENTCOM becoming the main effort again, just because of the fact they also see what happened, the lead up to our build up. Like, we literally sent over entire squadrons of F-15s and F-16s. We literally got a aircraft carrier group up and started from Virginia, Hampton Roads, sent it all the way to the Eastern Mediterranean in, I want to say, 10 days. We have more firepower in the Eastern Mediterranean than the entire region had beforehand. If we wanted to, we can go in and conquer the region. But, I use that extreme Belarus example just to prove to people that China sees that as well. And they realize that if the United States can do that in 10 days, what's going to stop them from doing that if we were to try something with Taiwan or the Philippines, when they have like close to 80,000 troops stationed in Japan, South Korea, and Australia? And a lot of people don't realize that, is that the Chinese understand that. And
I think it's actually white. I think the numbers in the six figures.
I wouldn't be too surprised. But yeah, I mean, it's one of those things in which China sees that and they understand it. No matter how many times I can say, like, how many people can say, oh, well, they're going to use, the Chinese are going to use this as a way to, you know, do something in Taiwan or do something over there. And I'm like, you do realize we have like two other carriers in the Asia Pacific right now, right? Like one is in the South China Sea. One was in the South China Sea when that incident, when the ramming incident occurred. And that's the reason why I want to say also the fact that the Chinese kind of didn't really do anything or like they lessened their reaction was because of the carrier group that was there as well as them like sending a message to the Philippines, as I mentioned earlier. I think that's the reason why they also like lessened their response. They responded to the, they framed the ramming incident like that.
All right, let's talk about China's ethno-nationalism and how it builds into this wartime strategy.
So you're talking about how China's, you know, Han culture could be used to, you know, play. Well, it's kind of interesting because Peter Sahan, he kind of hinted at this in the fact that, but he used it as more of a, why the Chinese Communist Party would say, or at least the, why China would, you know, still believe in the Chinese Communist Party, CCP.
Mm-hmm.
But you kind of, he kind of misses the point of the reason why Xi Jinping emphasizes being Han is unique, or being Han is a good thing, besides the economic, which is almost about to, is about to go away at this point.
Mm-hmm.
It's the fact that to Xi, being Han means you are connected to this ancient culture that spans 5,000 years, that we can lay claim to, that we are literally the oldest country, quote unquote, on Earth. That we, as the CCP, as the arbitrators of this 5,000-year-old history that we also like to destroy and amalgamate to our own ends, but we won't talk about that. We as the arbitrators of China, of jungle, we control the Chinese people. The Zhonghua Minzu, wherever you are. You could be in East LA, or in West LA, in New York City, Chinatown. You could be in Nigeria, Laos, Nigeria. You could be in Cambodia or Indonesia, Bangkok, Indonesia. You are still Chinese. You may not be Chinese by nationalist, by a national standard, i.e. Chinese by birth, Chinese holding a Chinese passport, but you are Chinese, you are Zhonghua Minzu, meaning you are a ethnic Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
And we are the arbitrators of that. We are the protectors of that. And it's very interesting because you kind of see them playing it up. And you do see some pushback against that, especially in, I want to say in April, the Singaporean parliament actually said, they usually speak in Chinese. One of the languages that they use is Chinese, because Singapore has a big, I want to say Chinese is the biggest population in Singapore.
Mm-hmm.
But they spoke in Chinese and made a point to say, we are Chinese people. They used, I forgot the word that they used, but they didn't use the word for Chinese people as in they're from China. They're using it more as, we're just Chinese guys. You don't control us. And so it was very interesting to hear that, to hear and see those characters used. But then on the flip side of that, and it kind of has a lot of merit to this, is the fact you kind of see the CCP using a lot of language that the Qing dynasty, the last dynasty of China, used to, in its final days, to control the Chinese diaspora. So it's very interesting to see the similar language come out from those two drastically different entities.
That is very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
This is it's a very interesting situation, because it's the thing that really gets me is that whole Peking Man thing. It just, it reeks of that sort of Nazism thing. You know, I really worries me.
No, I mean, it's one of those things in which a lot of people, and I will say this as someone who traveled throughout China and interacted with a lot of Chinese, you kind of get the feeling of how traveling through Japan in the 1930s what felt like, from a Westerner perspective. Because...
What do you mean by that?
Well, because you kind of felt in certain places, you could feel the nationalist and hear some of the nationalist rhetoric coming out. Like in Qingdao, I heard it a lot, especially around areas like the Chinese Navy Museum, the place within that was near the naval base that they have down there, the major one, not the submarine one, not where they keep the attack subs, but they where they keep the surface ships. I heard that a lot from that area just walking by, and I didn't even know until someone told me, until one of the professors told me 2 days later where we were walking by. And you heard all this nationalist rhetoric, this semi-racist rhetoric. And not only that, but then you also, but then also felt it increase in certain ways from my time, from my various times traveling throughout China year after year. You kind of get this, I kind of now I understand how they felt, like the Westerners who traveled throughout China or throughout Japan felt, because here's some of those accounts of those people, they receive the same thing, like, oh, but more overt, like, oh, well, you're just a Westerner, you mean nothing to us, you're Westerner, we're Japanese, we're the chosen people, we're the people of the sun, you're just a barbarian.
So how come the United States won't stop bullying China?
Well, it depends upon if you're going to go with the CCP and pro-Beijing rhetoric. According to that, the Chinese think that anything we do that prevents them from doing like a lot of the outrageous stuff, or stealing IP or technologies, is them being racist against China, which is not. It's not. Like, I know a lot of people who say this on social media, LinkedIn, things such as that, that say, oh, well, it's a more, this is more, you know, Biden's chip restrictions are morally reprehensible. I'm like, is it really, guys? Is it really morally reprehensible? Are you really attaching morality to economic sanctions when it's been proven time and time again that China steals literally anything that's not voted down in terms of IP, in terms of intellectual property?
Okay, so has any of this nationalism, like we talked about it earlier, but the 100 years of humiliation, how does that work into it? And how do they use, like, you know, their history of oppression to, you know,
They use that as a driver for it. You kind of see it, especially with in Xi Jinping, that the whole rejuvenation of the Chinese nation. That, you know, we're protecting you. I'm trying to give you your respect back. We're learning from the Qing Dynasty of old. Those people who didn't want to modernize, those people who didn't want to take Western concepts and use them against the Westerners to eject them or remove them from China. And that's where a lot of the movement for the IP theft, for the Thousand Talents Initiative, for the Made in China by 2025 kind of stems from. Because they understand, the CCP understands that they need the technology to, one, improve upon theirs, but then also make sure that they are either at the same level of the West, or more benefit, or more or better, move past that. And you kind of see them, and you can't, and you do see them attach a nationalistic and ethno-nationalistic segment to that as well.
When everything is like kind of all said and done, right? Obviously, none of us can really predict the future, but what do you think kind of Xi's legacy will be domestically in China? Like, how will he be remembered domestically?
Matt, it could go one of two ways, really. I mean, it could either be responsible for the downfall of the CCP because of its stupidity. And I say that...
That'd be epic.
It would be. It would suck bad for the world, for the rest of the world, but realistically, for the Uyghurs, Tibetans, Mongolians, the Manchu, and all the other ethnic groups would be happy that the CCP is gone. But on the flip side, if Xi somehow survives this and dies, and another person just so happens to be able to take his spot, then he would more likely be seen as another Mao Zedong. That you may have another Deng Xiaoping say that, you know, for all Mao's, for all the good that Mao did, like liberating us, you know, establishing, you know, the PRC, he did some bad stuff too, like the Cultural Revolution and the Great Leap Forward famine and the repression and so on. I could see his legacy going either those two ways.
So all these experts say that you know, China's the fastest growing economy and it's going to surpass America eventually. So when is America, you know, when is the American century going to end and China's time coming?
China's time may not even come. Their economy is slowing down. Their economy may not even be, this economy may not even recover from COVID-19 and Xi Jinping's common prosperity initiatives. There's indications that is the case, that, you know, it's been lagging for some time. Yes, you did see some growth in quarter three of this year, but I want to see growth. I want to see Q4's numbers before I say, okay, there's a slimmer of hope. But even then, that, you know, let's just say if China actually does somehow economically rebound, they still have to deal with the real estate crisis, the youth unemployment, and the debt that each province has. And China may not, or more specifically, Xi Jinping may not want to deal with that, but he has to. Because by now, they can no longer kick that can down the road like they did before. They cannot just simply say that, oh, well, we can get people to buy more of our stuff. People don't want to do that anymore. People understand the risk of being overly reliant on China for supply chain issues, for supply chain. They understand that. And so for them, realistically, they have to get people to consume internally, domestic consumption. Chinese people may not want to do that. They don't, we've seen them buy some stuff, but that was usually around the holidays. And now, but realistically, for them to say, for the Chinese government to pivot towards domestic consumption without setting the necessary reforms is a recipe for disaster.
So can we get into a little bit about how manufacturing is changing? Because they always say, you know, China's the factory of the world. How is that going to change in the future?
Well, China may, a lot of the companies who are smart enough will or have started moving their operations away from China mature, do you see this happening? You see a lot of companies reorienting their operation towards Vietnam, India, the Philippines, Mexico, surprisingly enough. The Dominican Republic is trying to get in on some of that action, but it's a little iffy at this point. And so you see them doing all these things. You kind of really don't see them getting it back because, again, companies understand the risk of relying on China to being the world's manufacturer. So they want to lessen that degree of risk. And then not only that, but again, going back to the domestic consumption aspect, they would have to reform the yuan in order for any domestic consumption to take hold and be significant enough to rejuvenate the economy. But Xi Jinping doesn't want that. No one in the Chinese Communist Party wants that because they understand as soon as they reform the yuan, then they will be at the mercy of the U.S. dollar and the U.S. dollar, the yuan, the yen, the pound, the euro, pretty much the reserve currencies of the world. They'll be at the mercy of them. And the yuan is not strong enough by itself. It's not strong enough to be a viable, to stand by really by itself without help from the Chinese government.
Tell the BRICS people that.
Help. From the Chinese, help, you know, they control basically whatever the currency is worth.
Yeah, it's one of those things in which, you know, India,
but they have so much less debt than America, that must mean their currency is more valuable, right?
No, they've their debt is real hidden. Like, to say that they have $1 trillion in debt is an understatement. I would probably put it as 2.5 trillion.
Is China a world power now? Is it going to stay a world power? Is it going to fall from grace? Let's kind of wrap up with that.
Also, is China a leader in green energy?
Yeah, no, you know what? You know what? Akami told me today that it's actually America's fault that China's like that because we buy all the stuff. So if they weren't exporting in their dirty factories everything we buy, then it wouldn't be contributing to the smog.
Yeah, sure. I mean, we told them to dump cadmium right next to the river. Yeah, sure, whatever. Logic. Mm-hmm.
Well, we support it with capitalism.
You know what? I mean, like, yeah, we may support it, but then also at the fact that, you know, when China puts in laws that, you know, the CCP officials say, we're not paying attention to this because that's more money out of our pocket. It kind of throws the wrench into that. But they have made some leeway in the environmental issues that they have, but I don't think China would ever be. There are certain parts of China that won't recover from the environmental devastation that they did. It won't ever come back. They can try, but it just won't. But regarding green energy, they want to, primarily because they need to repair their environment, but they also understand that a lot of the third world countries are now caring about the environment. Not only that, but they also see the potential windfall for investing in green energy, becoming the leader of green energy. Something the United States doesn't or can't do because of domestic political issues . And so you kind of see that. And then if China is a world power, I would say they would be a lower tier world power. I say that because they have, like, they still are economically powerful, even though they have, like, this, a lot of the economic issues. And they can get these countries who either are willfully ignorant to it or just plain ignorant to, you know, or just thinking that, oh, China can, you know, will always be here. That's not always the case because there's a real chance that China could collapse economically. And I think for them to say that China is a world power, I would say you need to ask that question again in the next 5 to 10 years, more so 10 years.
Is there anything China can do to prevent it, or is it too deep now?
I think there's a part of me that says they can do it. They can. There is some stuff like reforming the yuan. Xi Jinping needs to leave power. They need to redevelop their, they need a total reset of their diplomacy to make friends instead of treating people as lesser forms of humanity, or at least think of them as lesser people or subjects. But realistically, those three will not occur because they don't benefit the CCP in any way. And more importantly, Xi Jinping.
And how will the Western communist cope with this when China collapses, if it collapses?
They'll cry.
Okay.
That's all. I mean, like, the Chinese look at Western communists the way that, almost the same way that we do. I mean, like, they probably respect Russian communists or Eastern European communists more than Western communists, and specifically United States, because they see them as, like, I forgot the word for it, white
monkeys.
No, it was something really, I forgot what it was, like liberal, I forgot what it was, like by,
well, they're not listening, so.
Yeah, so it was something, but I would kind of chuckle because the slang term was like white something, and the translation was, and it was someone, it was a white Western leftist who doesn't know any better. It was like almost calling them a white idiot.
Ignorance is bliss, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right.